A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Welcome back to my weird prompts. So Daniel sent us this one, and it's a puzzle that's been simmering for years, but really boiled over since October 7th. A country with about 380,000 actual citizens, fewer than Tulsa, Oklahoma, hosts the political leadership of Hamas, gifted the United States a Boeing 747-8i for Air Force One, and has seen advisors to Israel's prime minister investigated for suspected bribery linked back to Doha. How does a state that small end up with that much reach into the most intractable conflict in the region?
The numbers really are staggering when you line them up. 380,000 citizens, but they've positioned themselves as the indispensable channel between Israel and Hamas, between the West and the Taliban, between everyone and everyone else. And the scrutiny right now is at a level we haven't seen before. From 2024 through this year, the accusations of double-dealing have been relentless. Are they a mediator or are they a sponsor? Can you be both?
That's the tension Daniel's getting at. It's not just that Qatar's influential. It's that the influence seems wildly disproportionate to anything you'd expect from a tiny peninsula jutting into the Persian Gulf, hundreds of miles from Jerusalem and Gaza. So where does this start?
To frame this properly, we are talking about a country that is, geographically, nowhere near the action. Qatar sits on a small peninsula sticking into the Persian Gulf. It shares one land border with Saudi Arabia. Jerusalem is about 1,100 miles away. It's not a military power. Its entire armed forces are maybe 12,000 personnel, and demographically, as you said, the citizen population is tiny. Yet when a ceasefire needs brokering or hostages need negotiating, the phone rings in Doha.
Which is the puzzle? Usually in geopolitics, influence tracks with population size, or military reach, or at least geographic proximity. Qatar has none of those. It's like a chess player who shows up with three pieces and somehow controls the center of the board.
That's exactly the right image. And we should be clear about our scope here, because Qatar's influence extends in a lot of directions. They've mediated in Afghanistan, in Sudan, in Lebanon. But we're going to focus on the Israel-Palestine axis specifically, because that's where the contradictions are sharpest and where the strategy is most visible. It's the case study that reveals how the whole machine works.
It's also where the costs of the strategy are most apparent. Hosting Hamas's political leadership while mediating between Hamas and Israel, that's not a sideline, that's the main event.
Here's the thesis we want to trace through all of this. Qatar's influence isn't just a happy accident of sitting on a giant natural gas field. It's the product of a deliberate three-phase strategy that unfolded over about 30 years. Phase 1 was survival through neutrality, carving out an identity independent of Saudi Arabia. Phase 2 was building soft power infrastructure, media, mediation networks, relationships with actors everyone else shunned. And phase 3 was becoming what you might call indispensable, the only address that could connect parties who couldn't talk to each other directly.
It's not they got rich and stumbled into relevance. It's a playbook.
A playbook that was designed, funded, and executed with real discipline. And the Israel-Palestine file is where all three phases converge.
Let's rewind to the moment this playbook gets written. 1995. Emir Hamad bin Khalifa al-Thani deposes his father in a bloodless palace coup while the old man's on vacation in Switzerland. And the first thing Hamad does is make a bet that almost nobody at the time thought would work. Qatar was not going to be Saudi Arabia's client state.
This is the part that gets overlooked in most coverage. The default assumption is that a tiny Gulf monarchy with a giant gas field would naturally fall in line behind Riyadh. Saudi Arabia is the regional heavyweight, the custodian of the two holy mosques, the anchor of the Gulf Cooperation Council. Most small Gulf states essentially subcontract their foreign policy to the Saudis. Hamad looked at that and said, no, that arrangement makes us permanently vulnerable. If we're just a Saudi vassal, we can be absorbed or squeezed whenever Riyadh decides we're inconvenient.
Which is a legitimate fear when you share your only land border with a country 10 times your size that's invaded neighbors before.
And Hamad's insight was that the way to survive wasn't to be militarily strong, that was never going to happen, but to be distinct. To build an identity and a set of assets that made Qatar useful to bigger powers on its own terms. And the first, most audacious piece of that was Al Jazeera.
Launched in 1996 with a $137 million grant from the Emir, which, at the time, sounded like a vanity project. A tiny Gulf state starting a satellite news network? It seemed almost quaint.
It was anything but quaint. Al Jazeera was the tool that let Qatar project influence into every Arabic-speaking living room from Morocco to Iraq. Before Al Jazeera, the Arab media landscape was dominated by state broadcasters that were essentially propaganda organs. Stilted, boring, nobody trusted them. Al Jazeera came in with a model that looked like editorial independence, covered dissident voices, aired Israeli officials speaking in Hebrew with Arabic subtitles. It was genuinely shocking.
The key thing is, this wasn't just about media freedom. It was a foreign policy instrument wearing a press credential. Al Jazeera gave Qatar a platform to shape how Arabs understood their own region. When the Second Intifada erupted in 2000, Al Jazeera's coverage was visceral. It showed Palestinian casualties in detail that other networks wouldn't. That built enormous credibility with Arab publics, especially Palestinians. It also infuriated Israel, which saw the network as incitement.
That anger was part of the design. By being the network that aired Arab grievances, that gave voice to Palestinians, to Islamist movements, to critics of Arab regimes, Qatar was positioning itself as something no other Gulf state dared to be. The Saudis and Emiratis were aligning with Washington and keeping dissent quiet. Qatar was saying, "We'll be the address for the people those governments won't talk to." It was a branding exercise at a civilizational scale.
Within a decade, Al Jazeera had more reach and credibility across the Arab world than any state broadcaster. Qatar, a country most people couldn't find on a map in 1995, now had the most influential media voice in the region. That's phase one. Survival through distinctiveness. But phase two is where it gets really interesting, because Qatar starts converting that soft power into hard diplomatic leverage.
The pivot happens roughly around 2010 to 2012, and the insight is deceptively simple. If you're the only country that can talk to everyone, you're valuable to everyone. Qatar looked at the Middle East and saw a region full of actors who couldn't communicate with each other. Hamas couldn't talk to Israel. Iran couldn't talk to the U.S. The Muslim Brotherhood was being crushed by Egypt and the UAE. Qatar's move was to become the switchboard.
The indispensable mediator niche. And it required doing something that looked reckless. Building relationships with actors that other countries had designated as terrorists or pariahs.
This is where the Hamas relationship becomes central. In 2012, Hamas's political leadership was in a bind. They'd been based in Damascus for years, hosted by the Assad regime. But when the Syrian civil war broke out, Hamas refused to support Assad's crackdown on Sunni protesters, which put them on the wrong side of their host. They had to leave, and fast. Qatar saw an opportunity and offered them a new home in Doha.
This wasn't charity. It was a strategic acquisition.
By hosting Hamas's political bureau, Qatar now had direct, unfiltered access to the leadership of the group that controlled Gaza. That meant Qatar could offer itself as a channel to Israel, to the U.S., to Egypt, for anything that required talking to Hamas. And almost immediately, that asset proved its worth. The 2012 Gaza ceasefire, after 8 days of fighting between Israel and Hamas, was brokered with Qatar playing a central mediating role.
The Emir even visited Gaza that same year, first head of state to set foot there since Hamas took control in 2007. That was a signal. Qatar was saying, "We're not just hosting these guys in a hotel somewhere. We're willing to break diplomatic taboos to be the bridge."
That visit mattered because it demonstrated commitment. Mediation only works if both sides believe you're serious and you're not going to cut and run when things get difficult. The Gaza visit told Hamas, "We're in this." It told Israel, "We're the only ones who can deliver Hamas. You need us."
Which brings us to the financial mechanism. Because hosting the Politburo is one thing, But from 2018 onward, Qatar started doing something even more direct, bankrolling Gaza's stability.
This is the part that sounds almost fictional when you describe it, but it's thoroughly documented. From 2018 through 2023, Qatar was sending roughly $30 million a month in cash to Gaza. That's about $360 million a year. And the money was delivered physically, suitcases of cash driven through the Kerem Shalom crossing from Israel into Gaza, coordinated with Israel's Shin Bet Security Service and the United Nations.
With Israeli approval.
With Israeli coordination. The Israeli government under Netanyahu signed off on this arrangement because it served their immediate interest, maintaining calm on the Gaza border. The logic was brutally pragmatic. The cash paid for Hamas's civil administration, for fuel, for salaries of public sector workers. Without it, Gaza's economy would collapse, humanitarian conditions would deteriorate, and the pressure on Hamas to escalate militarily would increase. Israel didn't want that, so they facilitated a Qatari cash pipeline.
Which created a dependency loop. Hamas needed the money to govern. Israel wanted quiet. Qatar was the only party that could deliver both. That's leverage over two adversaries simultaneously.
It's worth being precise about what was happening here. This wasn't humanitarian aid in the conventional sense. It was a de facto pay-for-quiet arrangement. Qatar was effectively underwriting the status quo in Gaza with the quiet blessing of both Israel and the United States. The Trump administration supported this mechanism because it reduced the risk of another Gaza war. Everyone knew the money was going to Hamas-controlled institutions. Everyone looked the other way.
By the time we get to 2023, Qatar has built an extraordinary position. They host Hamas's political leadership in Doha. They're the primary financial patron of Gaza's civil administration. They have a direct channel to Israel's security establishment through the cash transfer coordination, and they have Al Jazeera shaping how the entire Arab world understands the conflict. That's not a sideline. That's being embedded in the conflict's operational nervous system.
The key to understanding this is that Qatar wasn't doing it out of ideological sympathy for Hamas. This was transactional. Qatar's relationship with the Muslim Brotherhood and its offshoots, and Hamas is an offshoot, was partly ideological in the early days, but it evolved into something much more pragmatic. Hamas was an asset Qatar could use to make itself indispensable, the same way they'd later use the Taliban relationship for Afghanistan mediation or their Iran channel for de-escalation. It's a portfolio approach to diplomatic influence.
Build relationships with the people nobody else will touch, then rent out the access.
That's the cynical way to put it. The more generous framing is that Qatar identified a structural gap in Middle East diplomacy, the lack of channels to non-state actors and designated groups, and filled it. Either way, the result was the same. By 2020, Qatar had become the address for any conversation that required talking to Hamas.
The stage is set. Qatar's embedded in the conflict's nervous system, as you put it. And then October 7th happens. The whole arrangement gets stress-tested in the most brutal way imaginable.
Here's the paradox that defines Phase 3. Suddenly, hosting Hamas's political leadership isn't just a diplomatic asset. It's a political liability of the First Order. The group that just carried out the deadliest attack on Jews since the Holocaust has its political bureau living comfortably in Doha. You'd think Qatar would be scrambling to distance itself. But the opposite happened. Within days, Qatar became the indispensable channel for hostage negotiations.
Because they were the only ones who had the phone number.
The US, Israel, Egypt. None of them had direct, working communication with Hamas's political leadership. So even as American politicians were denouncing Qatar for harboring Hamas, the Biden administration was asking Doha to mediate. Secretary Blinken was on the phone with Qatar's prime minister within days. The contradiction was laid bare in real time.
Hosting terrorists and mediating with terrorists. Same relationship, different lighting.
The November 2023 hostage deal is the clearest example of how this worked in practice. Over 100 Israeli hostages were freed in exchange for 240 Palestinian prisoners. That deal was brokered primarily through Qatari channels, negotiators shuttling between Israeli and Hamas positions in Doha, with Qatari officials sitting in the room, translating not just language, but red lines and face-saving formulations. Egypt played a role too, but Qatar was the engine.
The US and Israel needed Qatar, even as they criticized it. That's the whole strategy in one sentence.
It raises the question Daniel's getting at about the double game. Because Qatar was simultaneously funding Gaza's reconstruction through the same cash mechanisms we talked about, and hosting Hamas's political leadership in luxury Doha hotels. The Emir's hospitality for a designated terrorist organization is well known, senior Hamas figures living in five-star accommodations while Gaza is being bombed. Critics call it terrorist hospitality. Qatar calls it diplomatic engagement.
I don't think those two things are as contradictory as they sound. The whole model is that you can only mediate if you maintain the relationship, and you can only maintain the relationship if you're a good host. The luxury hotel is part of the leverage. It gives you access and influence that a hostile relationship wouldn't.
That's the realist case, and it's not wrong, but it also creates a moral hazard. If Hamas's leadership knows that no matter what happens in Gaza, they have a comfortable fallback in Doha, that changes their calculus. The safety net Qatar provides isn't neutral. It affects how Hamas assesses risk.
Which is where the Air Force One gift gets interesting. In 2025, Qatar gifts the United States a Boeing 747-8i to serve as the new Air Force One. The Trump administration accepts it and spends up to $200 million retrofitting the thing. And everyone's asking, what is this? A thank you?
It's all three, but mostly it's a hedge. Think about the timing. Qatar is under maximum scrutiny for its Hamas relationship. There are bills floating around Congress to designate Qatar as a state sponsor of terrorism. The gift is a signal. We are not an adversary, we are a partner so close we're giving you the most symbolically loaded aircraft in the American fleet. You can't sanction the country that built your flying White House.
It's the geopolitical equivalent of showing up with a really expensive housewarming gift right when your neighbors are complaining about the noise.
The Trump administration accepted the plane, which is itself a massive diplomatic endorsement. You don't accept a gift like that from a country you're about to designate as a pariah. The $200 million retrofit cost, that's American taxpayer money, further entangled the two countries. Once you've invested that much in a Qatari gift, you're committed.
The dark side of this influence strategy shows up in the Israel scandal. Reports emerged from 2024 onward that advisors to Prime Minister Netanyahu were being investigated for suspected bribery linked to Qatar. The accusation is that Qatari money was flowing to people inside the Prime Minister's orbit to shape Israeli policy toward Gaza, specifically to maintain the cash pipeline and the quiet arrangements.
This is where the line between legitimate mediation and undue influence gets blurry. If you're Qatar, you want the Israeli government to keep the Kerem Shalom crossing open for your cash deliveries. You want the political leadership in Jerusalem to see the relationship with Doha as valuable. How do you ensure that? Or something more transactional?
The investigation is ongoing, so we should be careful about conclusions. But the mere fact that the question is being asked seriously by Israeli law enforcement tells you something about how Qatar's influence is perceived. It's not just soft power and mediation. There's a suspicion that the strategy includes financial inducements that cross legal lines.
Then there's Al Jazeera. In May 2024, Israel shut down the network's operations entirely, raided their offices in Ramallah, confiscated equipment, banned broadcasts. The official accusation was that Al Jazeera was functioning as a Hamas mouthpiece, compromising Israeli security. Whether you buy that or not, the shutdown was a direct attack on Qatar's most important soft power asset.
Qatar couldn't really stop it. That's the vulnerability in the strategy. Al Jazeera's influence depends on being able to broadcast. If a host government pulls the plug, the influence vanishes. Israel demonstrated that Qatar's media arm is only as powerful as the tolerance of the states it operates in.
Which brings us back to the sustainability question. Qatar's entire strategy depends on being useful to everyone simultaneously. But after October 7th, the contradictions are getting harder to manage. Israel is less willing to tolerate the Hamas relationship. The U.S. Congress is less willing to look the other way. And Al Jazeera's credibility, which is the foundation of the whole soft power edifice, takes a hit every time it's accused of being a state propaganda arm rather than an independent news network.
The playbook worked brilliantly for 30 years. The question now is whether it's outlived its shelf life. If we're pulling back from the specifics and looking at the architecture of this thing, what Qatar actually built is a playbook for how a small, resource-rich state punches 10 weight classes above its own. And the ingredients are surprisingly legible once you see them.
four pieces, I think. First, invest in a unique soft power asset that no one else can match. That's Al Jazeera, a network that gave Qatar a voice in every Arabic-speaking household and made it narratively indispensable. Second, build relationships with the actors everyone else shuns. Hamas, the Taliban, the Muslim Brotherhood. Third, convert those relationships into mediation capacity. Become the only address for conversations that can't happen anywhere else. And fourth, maintain just enough ambiguity through financial mechanisms that nobody can pin down exactly whose side you're on.
The suitcases of cash through Kerem Shalom. That's not just aid. It's plausible deniability dressed as humanitarian concern. Everyone involved can tell themselves a story about what's really happening.
That's the artistry of it. But the vulnerability is baked into the same recipe. The entire strategy depends on being useful to both sides simultaneously, and that's an inherently unstable position. The moment one party decides the cost of the relationship outweighs the benefit, your leverage collapses. Israel demonstrated exactly that when it shut down Al Jazeera in May 2024. Qatar couldn't stop it. The soft power asset turned out to be soft in the literal sense. It only works if the host government tolerates it.
October 7th may have permanently broken the equilibrium. Before the attacks, Israel was willing to look the other way on the Hamas relationship because the cash pipeline was buying quiet. After 1,200 Israelis were killed, that calculus changed. The same arrangement that looked pragmatic in 2022 looks like complicity in 2026.
Qatar can't easily pivot. If they distance themselves from Hamas, they lose the relationship that makes them indispensable as a mediator. If they don't distance themselves, the pressure from Washington and Jerusalem keeps mounting. They're trapped by the success of their own strategy.
Which means for anyone trying to understand Middle East politics, Qatar's role is no longer optional background. It's central. The old model of thinking about regional influence in terms of military power or population size just misses what's actually happening. Influence here runs through information control, financial leverage, and the willingness to maintain channels to everyone.
The practical takeaway for anyone following this conflict: the next time you hear about a hostage negotiation or a ceasefire being brokered, look at who's hosting the talks. It's almost certainly Doha. And that's not a coincidence or a convenience. It's the payoff of a 30-year strategy designed to make sure the phone rings in Qatar when the stakes are highest.
Understanding that strategy is the difference between seeing Qatar as a mysterious bit player and recognizing it as the stage manager.
Which brings us to the open question that'll define the next chapter. Can Qatar actually maintain this dual role after October 7th? The pressure is coming from every direction now. Israel's security establishment no longer sees the cash pipeline as a stability mechanism. They see it as a strategic error that enabled the attacks. And Hamas's critics in the region, particularly the UAE and Saudi Arabia, are leaning on Washington to force a choice.
The strategy worked for 30 years because the contradictions were manageable. But the contradictions aren't subtle anymore. They're dead bodies and hostage videos and congressional hearings. You can't finesse your way through that indefinitely.
The thing to watch is whether Qatar shifts. There are two paths. One is distancing, quietly reducing the Hamas presence, letting the relationship atrophy, repositioning as a more conventional mediator. The risk there is that without the Hamas channel, Qatar's relevance to the Israel-Palestine file drops sharply. The other path is doubling down, arguing that October 7th actually proves the necessity of having a channel to Hamas, and that abandoning it would make things worse.
There's a third dimension, whether other small states try to copy the playbook. The UAE has been building its own mediation portfolio. Oman has a history of quiet diplomacy, even Kuwait dabbles. The question is whether anyone else is willing to host the pariahs. That's the part of the Qatari model that's hardest to replicate, the stomach for the reputational cost.
The Emiratis, for all their ambition, are not going to host Hamas's political bureau. They've designated the Muslim Brotherhood as a terrorist organization. So Qatar's niche may actually be defensible, precisely because nobody else wants it.
Which is its own kind of moat. Your competitive advantage is that your competitors find your business model repulsive.
That's one way to put it. But here's the final thought I keep coming back to. Qatar's story is a reminder that in geopolitics, being useful is often more powerful than being strong. Military might and population size matter, but they're not the only currencies. If you can make yourself indispensable to bigger players, if you can be the only address for a conversation they need to have, you can wield influence wildly out of proportion to your size.
The catch is that usefulness is a fragile foundation. It lasts exactly as long as the need does. The moment Israel decides it can manage Gaza without a Qatari channel, or the U.S. decides the cost of the relationship outweighs the mediation benefit, the whole edifice gets wobbly. Being indispensable is a great strategy until you're not.
That's the question to leave with. Qatar bet 30 years on being everyone's necessary friend. The bet paid off spectacularly. But the bill for that bet, in scrutiny, in scandal, in moral complexity, is coming due now. Whether they can keep paying it is the thing to watch.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
Octopus chromatophores contain the same light-sensitive proteins found in their eyes, meaning their skin can essentially see light and respond to it directly. A discovery that only emerged after researchers realized a species thought extinct since the early medieval period had survived undetected in a deep freshwater lake in Bhutan.
Right.
A freshwater octopus in Bhutan.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, and thanks to Daniel for the question. If you want more episodes, find us at myweirdprompts.com.
Or email the show at show@myweirdprompts.com. We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.